from giant cabbages in Anaktuvuk Pass to hot springs power greenhouse tomatoes outside of Fairbanks to hydroponic farming in an Anchorage cafe basement. Technology is changing agriculture in Alaska. I'm Julia O'Malley, and today on Talk of Alaska, we'll be discussing innovations and how we grow things in this northern climate.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
This is Julia O'Malley. Growing up in Alaska, I remember that we always thought of good food as something that came from outside. We signed up to get peaches in the summertime that came in by plane. I don't think I had a mango until I was in college. I don't even get my parents talking about it. Like, they have some stories about canned peas and powdered milk that are pretty gross. But that's not how I think about it anymore. Increasingly across the state, Alaskans are able to buy more local food, it seems like. I mean, we were talking before the show, and it sounds like that a long time ago, people got more food than they do now from outside. But I am here with Danny Constantine, and the state executive director of the Alaska State Farm Services Agency, and farmer Alex Davis of AD Farms, who also heads up the farmers market in the Sears Mall. And we are talking about innovations in agriculture. Join us on the show. What kinds of local grown food are you eating where you live this summer? Let us know. The call-in number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, you can call 550-8422 or email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. Danny, can you start us off by telling us what the Farm Service Agency does?
Hey, Julia. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks
nice
for
to be
coming.
Here.
It's my first time hosting, so bear with me, people.
Okay. As Julia says, I'm the state executive director for USDA Farm Service Agency, and the Farm Service Agency is just one of the many, many, many USDA agencies that work up here in Alaska. Farm Service Agency is particularly focused on, as the name suggests, farms and farmers and people who are in the business of growing or producing something. And we have programs that are primarily on the financial side. If you want to get started on a farm, and you need some financing, and you go to the bank, and the bank kind of looks at you funny, like, we don't make loans for farmers. Then you can come to us, and we do make loans for farmers, and particularly for beginning farmers. We've got a new microloan program that'll get you in there quickly. It's a two-page application. We kind of try to make it easy for people to get started in farming. Or if you're cool, a traditional farmer and you need financing to buy some equipment or buy some new, you know, more land or something, you know. So we do a lot of that. Our job is really to try to make more successful farmers in Alaska. That if I can have more successful farmers, then I think the Farm Service Agency is succeeding. But I'm also on the board of the Alaska Food Policy Council, and that's part of what helps kind of get me going in the morning, too, is thinking about what does Alaska's food system look like? Where do we get our food from? How much food do we produce here? In 1955, Alaskans ate 55% of the food they ate here in Alaska was actually produced here in 1955. But now it's more like about 5% of the food that we eat here is actually grown and produced here. So that kind of importation, 95% of the food we eat is imported, you know, it makes us pretty vulnerable when you think about what could happen in a natural disaster, but other implications around what that means for our health, what that means for our economy, when the $2 billion that Alaskans spend on food is all, most of it's going outside, when it could be staying right here in our community and going to farmers like Alex and others who are in the business of producing food. So, you know, you look at our food system, it is also pretty interesting because we're different than other states. We've got a lot of subsistence, a lot of personal use. A lot of Alaskans have their freezers full of salmon and other stuff. So, but I also think it creates all these opportunities. And Alaskans are innovative, pioneer kind of spirits, and they're doing amazing things right now to kind of turn that around. And I think it's also turning around because consumers want local food. They want to buy it. They are looking for it.
The market is definitely changing. It seems like, and this food movement has really made a change across the United States. It seems like everything comes here late, though. you know, the stuff that's happening in Portland now, I can see that interest, that sort of fervent interest in local food that was kind of happening there 10 years ago, I think is starting to really pick up here. But Alex, can you tell us a little bit about your connection to local food? I know that you have a farm. I've been there. But tell us a little bit more about what you do.
Well, I've been farming for 12 years. My wife grew up on the farm. We moved down here 12 years ago to help out on the farm.
In Palmer.
Up on Lazy Mountain, and my brother-in-law rolled the vegetable end of his business over to me because it was too much to do vegetables and hay when it was hay season. You fast forward a few years, people kept asking me, you know, at the market where I bought into an established business. It was a great way to go. It wasn't big, but people are always asking where to get things like meat. And I listened to my customers. And so 5 years in or so, I got into raising pigs. And now I do 5 acres of vegetables a year and about 100 head of hog.
Wow. And organic.
Yeah. I started out as an organic vegetable guy. The paperwork kind of got a little overbearing for me, especially with different stages in life. And
How many kids do you have, Alex?
We have 4 now.
Yeah.
Our youngest boy died 4 years ago next week. So, you know, we've kind of been through the ringer through all that with our baby boy. That's kind of when I gave up the organic paperwork because it was just crushing me.
Yeah.
And by the time I came out of that grief time, my customers didn't really care.
Yeah.
So I just opted to not go back into the system on that.
But how you changed didn't necessarily change.
Yeah.
It was just
the paperwork.
Paperwork.
I grow exactly the same way I always did under my organic certification. I just don't have to do 15 pages of paperwork to prove it.
Well, it's interesting what you're saying about consumers, too, because I think it used to be when consumers were first learning about the food that they were eating and the vegetables they were eating, they were looking for organic. They're like, that's what I
they
want.
They are.
And now I think Alaskan consumers are more concerned with local. If it's local, it's probably going to be pretty good for you. It's probably going to be fresher. We don't have a lot of pests up here, so our farmers don't use pesticides. There's not a lot of that.
Not as much.
You know, so, you know, generally, our soil is good. It's clean. We have clean air. I mean, generally, the food that we grow here, whether it's the livestock or the vegetables, it's pretty good quality. So I think the organic label for a lot of the consumers that we're talking about is not as important anymore.
No, I really have gone, you know, I mean, I've watched some very successful farmers that I used to vend with at markets. And, you know, some of them are working with me now. But, you know, I've really watched more of the trend of knowing your farmer and getting to know that relationship, have that relationship, getting to know how many kids they got, you know, do their hands ever come clean again after they've been working in the soil all week? And, you know, that to me is more important because, you know, I mean, somebody says, well, what do you feed your pigs? So I whip out my smartphone and I show them the cover photo of my, of me holding fodder, because I take whole barley, I sprout it into barley grass, take 6 days, and I'm holding this big biscuit of barley, that's what they call it, and it's like 100 pounds, and that that is one tray of 16 that gets fed out every day to my 100 head of hog. And nobody does grass-fed pork, but somebody says, well, what do you feed your pigs? I show them a picture of me holding the feed.
Yeah. And that's like a uniquely Alaskan thing too, because it's such a small state. You know, we, everything is a small town thing. So being able yes. to like, I mean, I could call you up on the phone and be like, hey, Alex, will you come on the show? It's like, we have such a small place that, those relationships and are close. And so it's, I think it's part of our culture too.
But it's happening everywhere, as you say, in Portland or in other places around the lower 48. At USDA, we have a kind of an initiative. It's called Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food. Mm-hmm. It's that exact phrase that Alex just used. It's because that's what consumers are looking for. They do all over, not just in a small place like Alaska, but all over. People want to know where their food's coming from.
Well, and I think that's how you're going to get back to actual generational farming, is when you know your farmer, you know, and like in my case, you know, I'm 41 years old. I'm extremely young for a farmer. You know, national age
right,
for a farmer
is
old.
About 60 right now.
Yeah. And so I'm young, but my kids help, and they want, you know, my oldest is going to be 13. She was helping with chores at 7 o'clock this morning. She knows how to take care of my animals just as well as I do almost. And she's always watching. But you get into that whole mindset of being able to have generational farmers, and you get that again by, this is the guy that can provide for us, you know, because everybody can grow some broccoli and lettuce in their backyard if they got some space. But you need a guy like me in January, because I've got carrots, beets, potatoes, cabbage, and meat.
So let's talk a little bit about just how we make farming pencil out year-round. We were talking a little bit about earlier about value-added products, sort of. And Danny, you were just talking about how that is kind of the secret to kind of bolstering a local food economy. Can you talk explain what that is and talk a little bit more about that?
Well, when you think about what does a food economy look like, and what is the potential for food to build an economic base, you know, it's all these secondary things. It's not just that Alex produces both meat and vegetables, but he's now down at the Sears Mall. You know, it generates other things. He's selling he's created a market. There's other markets that have been created all around Alaska. We have one of the highest sort of percentages population-wise of farmers markets in the country.
Really?
Yeah. And we also have one of the highest amounts of what you would call direct sales. Most places with larger agricultural economies, the farmers are selling it to the middleman. Mm-hmm. But here in Alaska, we don't really have much of a middleman infrastructure. Because we're still kind of a pioneer state, we haven't really developed those distribution networks. So we have 13 times the national average of the amount of sales that are direct sales, that are going through those either farmers markets or CSAs or directly to restaurants, direct sales. In Alaska, about 2.2 million of our sales are direct sales. And that 2.2 million is more than our potato crop. I mean, a huge percentage of our agricultural products are being sold through the direct markets, and that's what makes it able to be profitable. Mm-hmm. Because one, as we were saying, the consumers want that. They love the direct sales because that's where they get to meet their farmer.
That's where the relationship happens.
And it's good for the farmer because he's getting a good price because he's not going through the middleman. So it enables the farmers to be successful.
So we do see local produce in the grocery store. Where is that coming from? Sort of, I see the lettuce and the potatoes and the carrots and that kind of stuff. Where, and is there a certain threshold where it becomes profitable for a farm to sell in that way instead of directly?
I think you have to be of a particular
size.
mass to make that work.
It's a scale. It's you've got to be.
I'm not that mass, nor do my wife or I care to get that big. We kind of like it to be a family farm where, you know, if you would have showed up on Monday 3 weeks ago, you would have seen three generations in the field working together. You know, my father-in-law driving tractor, my wife and I putting transplants in the transplanter, and my kids, my nieces and nephews, all making sure that they're packed in properly. So you got three generations working together. That doesn't work well when you get into a farm that's 40 acres of production. You have to have people.
Yeah. Although it's interesting in Alaska, like you say, Julia, it is small and everybody kind of knows each other. The big farms that do supply the big retail chains here in Alaska, where you're seeing them in the grocery stores, they're also family farms.
Mm-hmm.
They also have their kids a big part of their operation. And you know what? They're doing both. They're selling. They're big enough that they can sell into the big retail chains. But you'll also see them at the farmer's market, too. They're doing it all.
That's true. So is Vanderweil
one
thinking of? Yeah, I was thinking of that.
About the biggest we got.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's just, listeners out there, are you a farmer? Are you listening to us perhaps while you are picking your vegetables? call us and let us know what you think about this stuff. Statewide, our number is 1-800-478-TALK, 1-800-478-8255, or send us an email, talk@alaskapublic.org. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, Alex, is the situation with a slaughterhouse for your meat. Like, how does we could back up a little bit. How does the process work for you? How can you bring your pork to market? How does that work?
Once upon a time, I had a boar and a girl, and they had babies. It takes 3 months, 3 weeks, 3 days.
All right, sorry. Not that part.
Not that part.
You have a beautiful, full-grown pig, and it's time to make it into
Monday
bacon.
Monday morning yesterday. Sunday night, we put two pigs in the trailer. I have one that was spoken for a lodge down in King Salmon, and the other one was for me to sell as cuts at my farmer's market. I load them up in the trailer with my wife's help and the kids' help. Monday mornings, I take them down to the meat plant, and then I drop them off. They get weighed, they get stamped, they get sorted. They do their thing. They had a bunch of beef there, and they always kill beef before they kill pigs, so rarely am I ever hanging around long enough to even see how they actually process a pig as far as putting them down, because those usually happen in the afternoon.
So you don't put them down.
I do not.
Yeah.
It is very rare anymore for me to kill on farm. My insurance company really does not like that.
Yeah.
So when I kill on farm, it's for personal use. And so I've used Mount McKinley Meat and Sausage for about 6 years. Started out just doing half and whole hogs, doing the on-farm kill thing, and then graduated out of that into going, you know, I think I can make more money if I actually sell cuts. And to say to people, trust me, I know what I'm doing, give me money now, I'll give you a pig in 6 months and it's going to taste good, was a little daunting.
Yeah.
So I'm more, hey, come buy a package of two pork chops. And then the relationship begins there and it's a lot easier.
Yeah.
What I do with Mount McKinley is I drop them off. I get them back usually a couple weeks later. They're vac pack, cut and wrapped, USDA stamp on it, ready for me to sell.
And that USDA stamp, you have to have
I have to pay for that.
Yeah. And in order to get it, it has to go to certified.
Yeah. The plant itself, to be able to sell to the general public with, you know, as I do, there has to be a USDA processing facility to kill the animal and cut it up for me. Otherwise, I cannot sell to the general public.
Right. And that's USDA regulations, food safety kind of regulations, just to make sure that the public
and
is
my
getting
insurance company's regulations.
You guys, we have a caller. This is Amy from Palmer. Amy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Julia. Thanks so much for taking my call.
So what is making you want to call in this morning?
Well, I'm thrilled that you guys are talking about local food. Hi, Danny. Hi, Alex.
Hey, Lou.
Cut It with Alaska Farmland Trust.
Recognize the voice.
Yep. I just wanted to hear you guys talk about the future of the food movement. And two kind of quick questions. What you see as the number one issue facing young farmers in Alaska? And then, of course, I'd love to hear you talk about farmland preservation. And I'll take your answers off the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. I think the future is bright. As I was saying earlier in the show, I think there's huge opportunities for Alaskans to get into this market. The demand is there. It's coming from local consumers. It's coming from schools who are more interested in getting fresh local vegetables into their system, and USDA is really encouraging schools to purchase local through like farm to school programs. So the demand is there, and so I think Alaskans are going to meet that demand, whether it's in traditional farming areas like in the Mattsu or in Fairbanks or in the Kenai or up in Kenny Lake. Those people are going to produce more and more in order to meet that demand, or it's going to be in urban areas like in Anchorage, where they're downtown, making either sprouts or making lettuce or making food, making tofu, making things in urban areas, or if it's in some of our rural communities way out, off the grid, where they're coming up with innovative food production up there, whether it's in a container, indoor container or outdoor, or high tunnels are all over the state. We have more high tunnels in Alaska than almost anywhere in the lower 48. I mean, definitely the zip code where Homer is has the most high tunnels of anywhere in America. So
I want to talk about that more later in the show.
So I think, yeah, I think the future is bright for Alaska to be producing a lot more of our own food. Amy asked about the barriers. For beginning farmers, sometimes it's financing. Where do I get the money to start? As I said earlier in the show, USDA is very aware of that and is trying to make it easier for beginning farmers to get financing. What are some other issues? Education, training, how do you might want to be a farmer, but how do you learn to be a farmer? I think those are issues we need some more kind of internship and training programs.
So we have a bunch of callers, but Alex, did you want to add anything to that particular topic?
I think the future in Alaska agriculture really needs, we can't do status quo and feed ourselves. The Mattsu Valley's not big enough. Summers are still too short in Fairbanks. I think doing the conics, growing hydroponics or aquaponics is going to, long term, I think that's going to be where we're, as a state, we need to head. Biggest barrier to that right now is aquaponics is kind of a bootleg thing because you're not allowed to legally farm fish in Alaska, even if it's telepoli and not salmon. But, that's a legislative thing that would have to change to make aquaponics work, and you're never going to get organic aquaponics without fish.
Okay, let's talk more about aquaponics in a second. Let's take a call from Kurt in Fairbanks. He wants to talk turnips. What's up, Kurt?
Well, turnips, of course. So, greetings, Danny, Alex, et cetera.
Hey, Kurt.
So you mentioned 1955 being 55%. I would suspect that people ate a lot of turnips back then. So turnips are absolutely fantastic crop because you can eat them in the winter, eat the greens in the summer. And I think we need more winter food production in the summer rather than using electricity to produce food in the winter. And so there's the Alaska Turnip Project, which is in its fifth year currently. And basically that is to get people introduced to their first round of plant breeding. And plants are pretty adaptive to climate. So rather than getting your seeds from the lower 48 or wherever, I think we should be producing our own. And turnips are pretty easy. They produce a lot of seeds. They cross quickly. There's a ton of seeds available through the Cooperative Extension Service. And you can make them for sprouts. You can use greens. You can do your microgreens. But it's seeds are the basis of food production. And so, got any questions?
Well, I was just, thank you, Kurt, for bringing up turnips, because I was, one of the things that has been interesting is root cellaring. I think people are thinking more, I mean, even just kind of like on a really small scale, people are, you know, waiting till that last farmer's market and then buying up a bunch of roots and cabbage and that kind of thing. But turnips would be another thing that can, you know, cellar. But have you guys seen that on like a larger scale? Is that happening in Bethel?
Well, I mean, the idea of storage, when Amy asked what's a barrier, and I don't know necessarily a barrier to beginning farmers, but just a barrier generally in Alaska, is our lack of good storage. If we had more storage, then we could produce more, whether they're root crops or whatever it is, in the summer, as Kurt said, and then we'd have a place to keep it either in our own homes or on farm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've met farmers all around the state, say potato farmers, who say, look, I'm growing 10 acres of potatoes, but I've got 40 acres out here. I could easily grow 40 acres, but I'm not, because I have no place to store it. What would I do with all these potatoes? So I think the lack of good storage, whether it's root storage or above ground storage, is something that kind of limits our ability to produce more food here. By the way, USDA has a new program. It's a storage loan facility program. So we can lend money at a very low rate to farmers who want to build storage on their own farms.
Thank you, Kurt, for the turnip turn to our conversation. We have another caller on the line. We have SJ in Anchorage, and he wants to talk about local food safety. Hi, SJ. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. It's been a really interesting conversation. Thanks for having me. We're up here. I'm with Alaska Sprouts, and we've been producing food locally for 7 years now, and I've successfully selling it and marketing around. You know, one thing that the way the food distribution system in Alaska is set up, we have a real, local producers have a real challenge getting food out to the masses as well, even if we can produce it, just because the whole food safety and, you know, I mean, there's a lot of hoops that local producers aren't either willing or able to jump through to kind of supply the Kroger's and Albertsons and Costco's and Walmart's of the world as well.
And SJ, can you just tell us a little bit? I know you have your Sprouts business, but can you tell our listeners a little bit just about you're up to?
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
basically, Alaska Sprouts, we start off producing sprouts, like bean sprouts and clover sprouts, the stuff that, if you eat at your favorite sandwich shop or club restaurant, then that's basically our product. And then we grow microgreens, we grow lettuces and basils. We've been messing around with them quite a bit anyway. I can't say they're a really big part of our production. Microgreens we sell a lot of. And we also make tofu. Like today we're making tofu. So, kind of.
Are your products
producing stuff that people eat and that's getting shipped up from outside?
Are your products available outside of Anchorage?
There's up in Fairbanks, I know the co-op market up in Fairbanks has our sprouts and our tofu. We sell to a lot of restaurants all over the state. I was in Tok at that, there's a lady with a Thai food stand out there one day, and one of the local food distributors pulled up and delivered my sprouts to them while I was there eating lunch. So yeah, you can get our stuff statewide everywhere except in the Panhandle. So.
And you're growing hydroponically.
Yeah, we are growing hydroponically. And, you know, listening to the conversation, it's it's tough because, you know, most food is shipped up from Lower 48. And, you know, I mean, even if you look at, like, say, basil, for instance, which, I mean, that's a big market in Alaska, electricity is expensive. And, you know, this stuff's getting flown up from as far as Colombia, even. And, you know, sunlight's free. So it's the cost to ship is still not high enough that it overcomes the cost of electricity in Alaska. And, you know, as long as that's the case, you know, growing year-round under lights isn't as viable as you know, kind of the potential really, you know, the potential promises.
So. SJ, thank you so much for calling in. We're going to have to take a quick break, but when we get back, when we come back, let's talk more about hydroponics. And we'll also continue to talk about other ways that technology and climate change are changing agriculture in Alaska.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Julia O'Malley, and today we're talking about the ways Alaskans are producing local food from the villages to urban areas. I'm talking with Danny Constantine. Is it Constantine?
Constantine.
Ah, this whole time I've been mispronouncing. No, I'm here mispronouncing Danny Constantine's last name. He's the state executive director of the Alaska State Farm Services Agency, and I'm with farmer Alex Davis of AD Farms. I wanted to talk more about hydroponics. Alex, have you been experimenting with that sort of stuff at all?
I've been doing hydroponics in conjunction with my animals, not for human consumption. SJ and I actually work together at my market. I'm very happy to not have to go through what he does to maintain all those different microclimates for each of his different wonderful sprouts. I have a fodder system that can produce up to 1,600 pounds of fresh grass every day of the year.
And nice.
It works really well. Part of it became for me the labor conversion of when I had 20 head of hogs, they would go through a ton of dry feed every six days. And now I've gotten big enough where I can kind of hit a better economy of scale. I started to work instead of buying from feed stores for feed, which is extremely expensive to do. Whole barley can cost me $500 a ton if I go to a local feed store. Now I get it direct from Delta and I work with a trucker. You want to talk about how your money goes around to different places.
Wow.
I buy direct from Delta. Depending on the quality of the barley, I'm paying $220 a ton to $300 a ton. And I'm paying my trucker $70-$80 a ton to bring it. But it's a minimum load of 5 ton or else he's not stopping. And so, but what happened when I got into doing the fodder was that 1 ton of feed becomes, of barley becomes about 8 tons of feed. So, you know, like this morning we put 200 pounds of dry barley in the system to soak. And 6 days later, magically it appears, not really, but 6 days later that becomes about 1,200 pounds on
wow.
a really good day, 1,600 pounds of feed that goes right out the back door into the barn for my pigs.
So you're taking that barley and you're adding water and sunshine.
I'm adding water and electricity.
And electricity.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
To get six times.
I have I grow a lot of grass. It's just not grass that you can smoke or eat.
We'll get to that, too. I wanted to ask, Danny, can you tell me more about, there's a hydroponic project that the AC store is doing that you were telling me about?
Yeah. Let me just back up a minute about your question about hydroponics. I mean, it's not necessarily hydroponics, but I think what we're talking about is what is the potential in Alaska to produce more food throughout the winter or some other time when mm-hmm. we don't just have sunshine. And I think of that as a bigger group of things, more like greenhouses or what people yeah. call controlled well, environment. And not necessarily, yeah. it doesn't necessarily have to be a hydroponic way. People do grow in soil and there's other ways to grow inside a greenhouse. But the question is, you know, as SJ was saying, is what's the economics of pumping electricity, which costs money, mm-hmm. and heat, which costs money, into a controlled environment in order to produce a product, and can you compete with that product against other products that are cheaper yeah. and get shipped up here? That's the question. And I think the answer is it depends is
yeah.
the answer. And one of the things it depends on is how much does it cost to produce that product? And I think it depends where you are in Alaska. Mm-hmm. If you've got natural gas, like in Anchorage, you've got fairly low electricity rates, it might pay. If you're someplace where it's 40 or 50 cents a kilowatt hour, it might not pay. If you're in someplace, the Southwest Alaska Municipal Conference did a study on their communities in Southwest Alaska, and they found that places like Kodiak, which has fairly low power rates, they have renewable energy and low power rates, it would pay because it's high. It costs a lot to get there.
Listeners in Kodiak, we have a business idea for you.
A lot of business opportunities for greenhouses in Kodiak, but I think it just kind of depends. But I think one that the demand, as we're saying about the demand, I think consumers are willing to pay a little higher price for a local product because either they know their farmer, they'd rather buy it from their local farmer, or, you know, quality, taste, other things as well. So I think even if you can't quite compete just on price, I think Alaskans can compete on other issues.
Well, I mean, we've got an email here. I don't know about Anchorage, but in Fairbanks, farmers market prices for produce are 3 to 6 times that of the grocery store, putting it out of reach for most large families. The one or two vendors who charge less get complaints from the others, but tell me they just can't justify charging more. Until prices drop, it's going to remain a niche market for the well-to-do. This is Tom in Fairbanks. Callers, do you agree? Would you pay a little bit more? Do you pay a little bit more for locally grown food? The call-in number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or you can send us an email, talk@alaskapublic.org.
No, I agree that's an issue. And if we're going to have a food system that works for Alaska, which keeps us healthier, creates more jobs, keeps us better protected in case of an emergency, that's going to have to be for everybody, not just for those people who can afford it. And we do have to find a way to make fresh, good, healthy food available for everyone, that there has to be some equity here. I agree that that's something we have to work towards. One of the things we're doing at USDA is making farmers markets and food stamps, or the SNAP program, compatible, so that you can use your food stamps at a farmer's market and buy some healthy food. But what we're finding is exactly that you know, food stamp customers think it's too expensive. And so there are programs, and the state of Alaska did this. We had an incentive program. So if you brought your food stamps to a farmer's market, you'd get double the coupons. You get double the amount of money. So we're going to have to do things like that to make sure that this good, healthy Alaskan food is available for everyone.
I'm interested in what Village listeners have to say about this, because I know, you know, just my traveling, you know, far up north or far northwest, is that lettuce is crazy expensive. It seems like that food cost, base food cost, much, you know, might match up with how much it costs to grow that lettuce in your village, not just in the summertime, but maybe even hydroponically.
Well, and that is what they're doing in Kotzebue, you asked me about.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And I don't know that much about it, but I do know that the Village Corp in Kotzebue, looked at the numbers, did a business plan, really looked very carefully about that whole question is, you know, how much does it cost to produce heads of lettuce in a hydroponic container, and how much could we sell them for at the AC store? And they negotiated a deal with the AC store to say, well, we'll sell you lettuce for X price, and they're going to try it. And it seems like they planned it out. It looks like it is going to work for them. But I think you're right. I mean, I think there is an opportunity even in high-cost production because it's indoors and you're spending a lot of money on electricity and lights, but also because the price that is already there in the grocery store, you can probably meet or beat that price with a locally produced product.
The economics of it seem to vary throughout the state, and the cost of power is a really big piece of that. Alex, you look like you've got some to say.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of chomping at the bit on this one. You know, and I don't know. I am a high-end niche marketer. I will be honest about it. You will never find anything cheap from me at my market. I can't do it cheap. In order to compete with grocery stores, I would go broke in 5 minutes.
What about organic grocery stores, like a product that would be organic or that's fed the same way that your pigs are fed? Is it closer?
You can't get pork like what I produce. I know of like 10 guys in the U.S. that are growing pigs the same way I am. It's not available. It is very exclusive, very wonderful pork. Even vegetables, you know, when I was cutting my teeth 12 years ago, we had a saying, and that was Cars Rules. And that was, you go to Cars, you see what they're charging for Cars, you charge the same as Cars because yours is a whole lot better looking and it's fresh. And picked yesterday, I mean, how many times can you go to a farmer's market and the farmer says, oh, that was picked 18 hours ago. I mean, you're not gonna get that. As far as the prices, you know, that's all economies of scale, really. And so to come in with a 50-pound bag of potatoes for $20 when I'm having to pay $3 a pound for seed potato is not going to happen from a guy like me. That comes from keeping large quantities of seed potato, you know, or whatever you're doing for vegetables to try to drive the cost down. And you have to get into large-scale production to hit that kind of economy where you can always match or beat grocery store prices as far as price, but as far as quality, you know, all of us are pretty good about beating the grocery store up every day of the week.
But I would say that, yes, we have more small farms, primarily small farms in Alaska. There's not that many big farms that can kind of get into
there's
that.
There's 10 big farms.
Yeah, but I would say there's a lot of successful small farms in Alaska. We have over 700. There's about 750 farms in Alaska, okay? As Alex says, only 10 of them are big. So over 700 small farms are still in business. Alex is a small farm. He's been in business for 12 years. I'm a lender at USDA. We make a lot of loans. I can tell you we don't have a lot of defaults. We are making a lot of loans. People are paying back their loans. It's working. You can have a successful business. Like any business, you have to be a good businessman. A farmer.
If you're not on it, you're going to lose it. Well, it doesn't matter how you do business.
And the skill set for a farmer is very broad. think of all the things you have to know about. Yeah. You know, we're talking a lot about marketing, but you got to be a good marketer. But you have to be a good grower.
I was talking to my wife last night, and she's like, "Oh, you're going in tomorrow, right?" And I said, "Yes." And she says, "You know, I'm going to be weeding tomorrow." I said, "Yes, I know you're going to be weeding tomorrow, and then I'm going to come home, and we're going to pick so that we have something to sell at the market tomorrow on Wednesday." And I said, "So, you know, we could talk about my education, you know, and that I have a bachelor's degree in Bible, and then I have a PhD in horticulture, and I have a PhD in animal husbandry, and I have a minor in veterinary, but three of those are all School of Hard Knocks."
Veterinary.
You learn, and part of what, you know, we've talked on just briefly for upcoming farmers is teaching. And one of the hardest things as a producer is people want my advice. People want to know what my seed varieties are. My wife handles that, so I can't tell. Because that is like the only secret we have is what type of carrots do you grow?
Right.
I can't tell you. I don't ask my wife what type of carrots I grow. I say, this is how many pounds we need to put in the ground. Let's get weeding.
that sounds like a good business model.
I think it is challenging. It's definitely a challenging business here in Alaska, but because, I think Alaskans are suited. I think we are. I think we're hard workers. We're innovative. I think some of the veterans here coming out of the service are who want to stay in Alaska. I think they've got great skills that they could become farmers. I mean,
well,
I think
if you're willing to do
we
the
have
hard
any
work
farmers
the time,
out there listening who would like to join the conversation? You can call us at 1-800-478-8255 talk, or that would be 550-8422 in Anchorage, or email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. One of the things I wanted to talk about is pot, since we're here.
I grow grass, but not that type.
Yeah, no, well, but like, you know, Danny, like, how does that work? Like, are farmers thinking like, well, this might make more money. I should go into the pot sort of side of things. Is that a totally different thing? Can you get a loan to like
you can't
have
get
a pot high tunnel?
No, you can't. No, you can't get a loan. No,
I don't think you can get insurance either.
No. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of challenges to like that business, but theoretically you can make a lot of money, and in other places big business is getting into that business. So
sure, and it's going to start here in Alaska, and there are farmers who are going to get into that business, and they're going to figure it out. I think it's really different. I think it's a different kind of grow. It's not just like same kind of growing that Alex does. It's very different. It's very specialized.
Yeah,
it is. And
what are the demographics in terms of who's farming? Alex said that you're on the young end of things.
I am. And I know like a half dozen farmers younger than me, which kind of, you know, and the upside is like with me and my family, you know, there's 13 nieces and nephews that I have. All of them think they're going to grow up and farm. Now, if we can get three of them that actually do, we're good. But the question is getting them a skill set, a market. Do they even want to farm the way you farmed? I mean, those are really hard questions.
Yeah. And Julia, you know, this brings me also to the thing of like, so what can our institutions, what can our government, what can the state, what can the feds, what can the tribal governments and the corporations, what can those institutions do to help? You know, this isn't something I don't think we should be sitting here going, well, we're just going to have to figure it out by ourselves. I think we need our leaders to look at this and say, we got to do better. We can do better. What, as Amy said, what are the barriers? Sort of identify the barriers and let's see if we can bust through those barriers. And, you know, so an education is one of them. Made me think of that when you said, you know, what can we do in our schools?
Drive,
what can we do to help?
Can you get a degree in agriculture in Alaska? Can you study it here or get a minor or
at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, there's a bit more of a program around natural resources.
We have one more caller. We have Paul from Galena who wants to talk about root cellars. Okay. Hi, Paul.
Hey, hi, Julia. Good morning.
Tell us about root cellars. Are you doing some root cellaring up there, over there?
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, this is kind of a crossover between what Dan was talking about, affordability, and the root cellar. You know, I have a really big garden up here in Galena, not necessarily a farm, but, I mean, you know how it goes in a village, you know, you're giving away your food all the time. Yep. So I'd say we probably give away about a third of what we grow. But I was thinking about the affordability thing. We have a root cellar that copies the idea of the Yupik Goski, where I took a shed, I built it without a floor, and then I covered it with dirt.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, it cost me $4 a month in the winter to keep it warm enough so that it's at freezing. I have a single incandescent light bulb inside.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Wow.
I built my house with a root cellar in it.
We have about 250 pounds of potatoes in there. We have cabbages, carrots, turnips, daikon, radishes. We learned that you can take, like, if you pull the kale and celery out full root, and you put it in a 5-gallon bucket with a half inch of water, that's enough to keep that stuff fresh up until about January.
Wow. That's great. We should come in at tour your root cellar, it sounds like. We have to go to a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk more about innovative ways that Alaskans are growing food. And also, you know, I wanted to have a little time to talk about how climate change is influencing, you know, agricultural trends here. So we will talk more when we come back.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Apollo MT by Guardian Flight, Medevac memberships that protect you or a family member when there is a need for air medical transportation. Information available at apollomt.com.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to a 4-year college or other post-secondary education. Explore your talents and develop your dreams at Mount Edgecombe High School. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
Welcome back. We are here on Talk of Alaska talking about Alaska agriculture. We have time to just have a few more calls. Let's see. Oh, we've got Joe here from Valdez. He wants to talk about hog fodder.
Yes.
Hi, Joe.
Hi.
What's up?
Yeah, so I was very interested in what you were talking about as far as growing your own fodder there for your hogs.
Yes.
You know, we've been getting into hobby farming and got a garden going, got a bunch of animals, and, you know, we buy all our feed from a feed store. And like you say, like you were talking about earlier, that gets pretty expensive.
Yes, it does.
And, you know, some people are more inclined to share information as far as where they get feed and how they make their feed, and others, you know,
yes, also, some people guard it very heavily.
You know, where did you learn about, you know, growing that and how that process works? And then as far as, like, your contact information for getting your barley and Delta, you know, are there resources out there to be able to share information like that? Or
There are resources. I mean, one of you hit on it very well. One of the hardest things is, there's several of us doing fodder in the state for various animal production. And some of us will let others on the property, but nobody is ever forthcoming about who they actually buy their barley from. And all of us have spotty germination at a time. We don't know if we're even getting it from the same farm or not. I have worked with 5 different barley producers in Delta over the years, and I have wonderful success with all of them and really bad success with all of them. It's very frustrating. I started to do the fodder about 5 years ago. I built my own system and ran into a brick wall at about 3 years in. I just couldn't get it better, and I wound up flying outside to Washington State to see one on a dairy farm that was actually professionally built, and it's by a company called Feed Your Farm. And I read about them in the Acres magazine. And so I called them up. I said, hey, when can I come? They said, this day. And I jumped on a plane and I went. And so fast forward 6 months, $15,000 for the unit and probably another $15,000 for my barn to house it. And that got me into fodder. And then I realized very shortly that it really comes down to the barley. And if we can't have consistent barley that's got 90% germination, it's rough. At about 60% germination, you might as well be feeding them dry feed. So, you know, there are ways to get in touch with me. The easiest way is to text or email me, but I'm not sure if I want to throw my phone number out on the radio.
But you can, AD Farms is online. You can just Google it up.
Yeah.
And there's contact information on your website.
Or you can go to thecentermarket.com, which is my farmer's market, and all my contact info is on there.
Before we go, I wanted to have you guys talk a little bit about, you know, we know that we have experienced a number of really warm summers recently, which is
two.
two. Yeah, but that it feels like a lot. I thought it's been well, I guess, and cool and warm winters as well. But has that influenced what people are growing?
My pigs love the warm weather, I'll tell you that.
Is it changing how people are sort of, how, you know, is the growing season longer? Is that just my imagination? Seems like things are early this year, but that's just my garden.
There's a certain group that always pushes the envelope on the get in early. And I know some of them are very successful at that or have been the last couple of years. 3 years ago, we had a very warm spring. And then the bottom fell out about mid-May, and a lot of guys that planted early, I had a lot of stuff get killed. So, for me as a vegetable guy, I'm going to need probably 5 to 10 years of consistent, you know, early springs are not killing frosts in May before I risk a lot of my livelihood, because I do my starts in April. My first set goes in the ground May 10th usually. And, that's probably $10,000 worth of income for my family if I put it in the ground a week earlier, say, you know, May 2nd-ish, and then I put it in and it gets killed. I just took it for 10 grand, and I don't know if that's a mistake I can recover from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the last 2 years, I have planted carrots, you know, all my direct seed stuff's gone in early May instead of mid-May. And,
what the climate scientists always, when I talk to scientists, what they always try to remind me is that there's climate and then there's weather.
Weather, right.
Okay, so it is indisputable that the climate is changing and that the earth is warming, and it's warming way faster in Alaska than it is anywhere else. That is undeniable. The science shows that it's warming. But in the middle there, the weather is going up and down and up and down, and we will have particularly warm times, and we will have particularly cold times. And as a matter of fact, the other thing that climate change brings is more extremes.
Right, and wet.
We may have weathers, El Niños, yeah. There's La Niñas. Yeah. We're going to have changes within that. It's not going to be always, it's generally getting warmer, but within that, it's going to be, and I think that presents both challenges because of the extreme nature of how climate change is changing, how things are going for farmers, but also opportunities, because, yes, generally it is going to get warmer, and that's going to provide maybe a longer growing season eventually. For things like wheat, as Alex says, barley grows great up in the Delta area, but those same farmers often plant wheat, and they don't know, it doesn't always work. So
it seems like it's just hard to predict. I just want to thank you guys for coming on the show, and thanks for listening out there. Have a nice day.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.